I'm speaking with harpsichordist Jason Moy of Trio Speranza, and I'm hopeful that this will be a fun interview for both of us. Jason, thank you so much for talking with me about your appearance at the Michigan Festival of Sacred Music.
Thank you for having me, and yeah, the trio and I are super excited to perform in Kalamazoo this weekend, and yeah, we're very much looking forward to it.
Well, I was trying to make a play on words there, because if my Italian is any good, Speranza means hope, right?
Yes, it certainly does.
Tell me about forming the group.
The cellist Cora Swenson Lee and I had collaborated pretty extensively. We're both from the Chicago area, and over the years, I went away to school in Canada, came back to Chicago, where I teach now. Cora and Anna had ended up in Boston, another great early music town, where they were doing some graduate studies. And when we decided a couple summers ago to present a concert at the Boston Early Music Festival in 2013, I believe, we put a program together. Just, you know, we wanted to have fun and play some of our favorite music. Anna and I had collaborated actually in Toronto at the Tafel Music Baroque Summer Institute many, many years ago, and we sort of all knew each other through various avenues. So putting together the program was so much fun, and our concert was met with such critical acclaim that we tried to see what we could make of it. And, you know, we put on a couple of other programs. Being from different places, it sort of presents some logistical challenges, but I think it also helps to make each music-making experience extra special for us, because it's an opportunity to really delve into the music and work with people we like working with. So that led to the Baroque Performance Competition, sponsored by Early Music America in October of 2014, and it was here in Chicago, so it was really great, kind of like coming back to home base. And we ended up winning the presentation prize, and now we're sort of just we're touring around doing programs in and around the Midwest. We have some programs in Boston planned for next season, soon to be announced, and we're excited what the future holds.
Isn't it great to live in a world where people's love and interest in early music is such that there are competitions for early music ensembles?
Yes, Early Music America has been just a driving force in the United States and Canada for just early music advocacy, especially focused on the young performers. I think sort of the next generation of early music talent. And for that, I think the entire community, both the established and the up-and-coming, are extremely grateful.
Well, let's look at the idea of a Baroque trio of violin, cello, and harpsichord. First of all, why don't you tell us how it differs from the modern piano trio of violin, cello, and piano?
Well, interestingly, the instrumental combination we have, traditionally in a modern piano trio, the piano has a very sizable solo part or solo role, sort of as an equal partner with the others, sometimes outshining the other two, to be perfectly honest. And if we sort of dial back a couple of centuries, the harpsichord had traditionally, in an ensemble setting, functioned very much as an ensemble instrument, sort of like a piano in a jazz ensemble. So responsible for the rhythmic and harmonic support, everything that the harpsichordist plays was traditionally improvised. So the left hand shared what the cello plays, but the right hand was entirely sort of made up on the spot, using some chord symbols, very much, again, like modern jazz pianists do. But the music that our trio tries to explore around the 1720s, 1730s throughout Europe, there was a movement, in a way, to break that reliance, the cello and the harpsichordist sort of symbiotic relationship, and to showcase the cello in a more solo, prominent solo role as well. So we've had a lot of fun sort of digging through, trying to find music that casts the cello and the violinist as equal conversational partners. So in a way, you could say our trio looks forward to the role that a piano, violin, and cello plays in a modern trio.
Bach famously let the harpsichord loose in his Brandenburg Concerto No. 5. He let it go crazy with a fantastically difficult virtuosic solo. Obviously, that's a bigger ensemble, but is that a bit of a watershed mark, perhaps?
Certainly so. And for me personally, I mean, that was the piece. I remember picking up the English concert, the recording of the Fifth Brandenburg Concerto in a sort of a bargain basement CD bin and just being completely enthralled by that cadenza. And I listened to it over and over and over again. And it was really that piece, I think, that made me fall in love with the harpsichord. And to this day, it still holds a special place in my heart and in the history of Western classical music. As you said, it was sort of the one of the first instances where the harpsichord broke free of its
supportive
role.
Yeah.
Yes. And sort of took the stage for a little bit before returning back. It's sort of like, look at me, here I am. And in a way that I feel that that's very much what Bach did for music. He sort of broke all the rules.
I can go through the stacks here at WMUK and find dozens and dozens of works called trio sonatas by so many composers of the Baroque era. You get the sense that this was a common and somewhat important form of chamber music at the time. What are some hallmarks of this style?
Sure. I think at its very basic level, the trio sonata was an instrumental piece for two melody instruments, two treble melody instruments, like two violins or violin and oboe, violin and flute, two flutes, with some sort of instrument or instrumental group, whether it's harpsichord and cello or just solo harpsichord, in the basso continuo or supportive role.
Right. That's what gets confusing, because sometimes it's four players playing a trio sonata.
Exactly. Right. It's sort of helpful to think of that, the harmony and rhythm group, as one unit against sort of supporting the two melodic instruments. And in the trio sonatas that we are presenting on the program, especially the two by Buxtehude, who was an early North German, very influential North German keyboardist and composer. He was sort of Bach's idol. I always say, like, if Bach had an iPod or an iPhone now, I guess, which composers would be on it? Buxtehude certainly would have been on Bach's, playlists among his sort of top musical influences. And those trio sonatas have the violin and a viol da gamba, which the cellist is sort of playing that line, has those two instruments as the melody with a continuo group, which will be played by me on the harpsichord. But it's possible to have a cello and harpsichord or another viol da gamba. So, you know, the continuo group can be as big and as varied as you want. It could be harpsichord, lute, organ, and cello, but that those four instruments function as one.
It's what's so fun about this era is we're in a period of transition, you know, and the viola da gamba is, its usefulness may be giving way over to the stronger, more present cello, perhaps, and yet they're both vying for performances. And like you said, harpsichord, organ, and lots of strange new things called forte pianos are cropping up.
Yes, I mean, in the same way, it's sort of like the piano and the harpsichord coexisted for quite a long time before the forte piano sort of vanquished the harpsichord for a good century and a half or two. The cello and the viol da gamba coexisted for a period, too, before the cello sort of just took over in terms of popularity. I think the viol da gamba in a lot of countries like France had connotations, very strong sort of connections to the nobility and with the revolution and changing tastes and sort of the rise of the bourgeois class, the cello, you know, and the violin and the fiddles and everything. It's sort of the the spirit of the common people sort of took over, and composers really rose to the challenge. And, you know, the early viola da gamba cello composers, like, they wrote such virtuosic music really to showcase the capabilities, tremendous capabilities of these newcomers.
But you said that, you know, people wanted to have instruments in their hands, playing at home for pleasure and fun. And so it was a populist demand for music that everyone could play as well.
And it certainly, we're very thankful for that, because without that movement, the rise of the amateur music-making class, you know, people who had instruments at home and had to buy music, printed music to play at home, we probably wouldn't have as rich a repertory as we do today. A lot of this music, Buxtehude, Bach, we suspect that the surviving printed music, I mean, it's such a small percentage of their actual total output. A lot of it was in manuscript, pieces written for one singular occasion and then discarded, sort of how, you know, we regularly print things out, you know, from on the computer, and then, you know, we use it for whatever we do and we recycle it. You know, there was very little thought, I think, for posterity that, you know, 300 years later, people would be playing music that they wrote. You know, there's a very, people often ask, like, you know, if Bach had a time machine and came back, came to the future, to today, what would he say to us? And there's a very good chance he'd be like, why are you playing the music that we wrote 300 years ago instead of playing stuff you're, you know, the composers and performers back then were often one and the same. So it wasn't until this rise of the amateur music-making class that the notion of buying printed music to play became a thing.
I'm speaking with Jason Moy of Trio Speranza about early music. Trio Speranza will collaborate with Early Music Michigan in a concert for this Saturday at First Congregational Church at 8 o'clock. It's part of the Michigan Festival of Sacred Music, and details are available now at mfsm.us. Jason, tell me a little more about the program and what else besides the Buxtehude we can look forward to.
We have Buxtehude, sort of the composer I was most influenced by him, a very early work, but famous work by Johann Sebastian Bach. I feel no Baroque program would be complete without a showing by J.S. Bach. So we have the Chromatic Fantasia in D minor for solo harpsichord, which I'll be very excited to present. And this, again, is, you know, we have the image of Bach in our head from his famous portrait of sort of this very serious, you know, older, very wise composer with the wig and everything. And the Chromatic Fantasia, I think, captures Bach's youth, which was very different. You know, he hadn't matured. He was certainly a virtuoso without equal, but he liked to show people that. Say it was just a show off, and I think this piece sort of goes all over the place. It really explores this notion of the Stilus Fantasticus, which is the fantastic style. Buxtehude was a great exponent of this style. It's basically taking a form and showing all the various permutations you can sort of derive out of it. So we have music by Bach. We have music by Johann Heinrich Schmelzer, who is a violin virtuoso. He was sort of the first German or German-Austrian violin virtuoso in a field very much dominated by Italians. A generation later, we have Arcangelo Corelli, who sort of wrote the book on the 18th century violin sonata, and we have a selection from his very famous and very important Opus 5. We have also a very fun piece by Domenico Gabrielli for cello and harpsichord. Gabrielli is sort of very underrepresented in the history of music, but wrote some tremendous and very virtuosic pieces for that instrument, showcasing the cello as a soloist. And then, of course, we have two wonderful collaborative pieces by Vivaldi, the other giant of the Baroque era, with Early Music Michigan, the singers, two sacred works befitting the theme of the festival.
Wow, you just rattled all that music off by so many different composers. You really aren't ever going to run out of things to play, even if you stick to the Baroque era, are you?
People often ask me if I have delved very much into modern music for the harpsichord, and I tell them, you know, if you take starting from 1800 or a little bit before and you keep going backwards, there's so much music there left to be discovered, and, you know, someone's got to do it, and I think there's some amazing treasures there awaiting discovery.
Also, a harpsichord is not a piano. And being a harpsichordist and a pianist is not the same thing. Elaborate on that as a player.
The harpsichord was sort of the primary keyboard instrument of the Baroque period. The first versions of the harpsichord arose, you know, in the late 1400s, and you know it existed, as I mentioned before, well into the 1800s, coexisting with the early piano for quite a few decades. It plucks the strings, similar to how a guitar or harp is played, but the keyboard activates the plucking mechanism. So in a way, it differs. It's in an entirely different family from the piano in that the piano strikes the keys, so it's generally considered a percussion instrument. The harpsichord has a lot of sort of the sound colors and techniques similar to the plucked string family, like the lutes, guitars, and harps.
And the action on that keyboard is nothing like what it feels like to play a piano.
You know, a lot of people, they look at it and they're like, it has keys. You know, any pianist should be able to sit down and sort of instantly feel at home. And what, you know, certainly what I discovered in the very beginning and what my students, you know, regularly discover is that it is entirely different. It works very much the opposite. I think that the sound, the plucking mechanism activates the sound at the top of the keystroke as opposed to the bottom. It's different enough that, it's certainly beneficial to really come to terms with the harpsichord as, you know, as the instrument it is instead of bringing piano technique over.
It will be very exciting to hear you play that solo, the Chromatic Fantasy by Bach on Saturday, along with music of Trio Speranza and those wonderful variety of sonatas by Corelli and Schmelzer and Buxtehude, and collaborating with Early Music Michigan on Vivaldi. Finally, Jason, did you ever have a point where, you know, it was hard to go forward as a musician in your studies, just you were overwhelmed, you'd burnt yourself out a bit? Who are some of your favorite people in early music who either talked you back into it or just gave you that inspiration you needed to keep going?
Well, I think as I mentioned earlier, I had started my college studies as a physics major. And by the time I realized my love for the harpsichord, I was entirely committed. But I did have some very influential and very generous people along the way who have, you know, to this day still are just there as a support network. Another Chicago native and a very prominent harpsichordist, Jory Vinicor, was very influential in getting me to explore the option of going to McGill for my studies, and I'm, of course, endlessly grateful that I took his advice and went there. My teacher at McGill, Hank Knox, a tremendous, tremendous teacher and just a wonderful human being. The years I spent there working with him were just completely transformative. And to this day, I mean, the harpsichord community in the States is certainly pretty small, but even throughout the world, and it's a pretty close-knit network. And the Norwegian harpsichordist and conductor, Kjetil Haugsand, who was just here in Chicago last April performing a concert solo recital at DePaul, he's just been a fount of knowledge and just sort of collegial spirit, and has been, I don't know, he's a role model. So I'm grateful that I have all these people to look up to.
That really warms my heart and makes me hopeful for the future of early music. Thank you, Jason, for talking about Trio Speranza at the Michigan Festival of Sacred Music.
Thank you very much. We're looking forward to performing this weekend.